Let's start with a little bit of Parsha. I remember when I was in yeshiva in Eretz Yisrael, at the beginning of my Shana Bet, there were some Shana Aleph guys who were leaving yeshiva on Thursday nights and Fridays to hang out with girls in Yerushalayim. Karen Biavne. A little surprising, no? I tweeted yesterday about how the security guard's job in every shul is to provide Yankee scores for someone, and someone who I know, who I'm very close with, who's a Shana Bet student in a particular yeshiva, said, "Oh, that's the Shana Aleph guy's job in our yeshiva." We're not gonna reveal what yeshiva we're okay. But anyway, so. So this goes back a ways, and I remember the American Mashkiach at the time got wind of this, and he called all the American Bachrim together for a shmooze, and he started the shmooze by telling a story of a couple in Bnei Brak that had a little boy, and they wanted to raise the boy b'kedusha v'tahara, that he should never see anything that would give him any sort of taiva or any sort of yetzer hara. So they decided that they would never let him see a female. They would never let him see a girl. I don't know, Kasha and the mother, I don't know, whatever. But they arranged with the neighbors that there would be a few hours each day where their daughters wouldn't be allowed out of the house. And that's when this young man went to Cheder, that's when he came home from Cheder. And the plan was working great, until one day one of the neighbors didn't get the memo in time, and the boy left his house, and he saw standing right in front of him, there was a pretty little girl standing right in front of him. And the boy couldn't take his eyes off her, and he said to his father, "Tati, what is that?" And the father said, he was flustered, he didn't know what to do, so he tried to think on his feet, he just blurted out, "That's a chicken." And he said, "I want a chicken." So, all right, it wasn't that funny back then either, but when Adam meets Chava for the first time, see what I did there? He is smitten, and he wants a chicken. I mean, he wants Chava. So naturally, Adam names Chava appropriately by saying Zosapam Etzame Atzamai Ubasam Nibsari Lezosi Kari Isha Ki Me Ish Lukacha Zos, that he names her, he calls her Isha because she was taken from Ish. But then, just like one parak later, after the Torah tells us about the Chet Eitz Hadas, Adam names Chava again, but this time he calls her something else. And Vayikra Adam Shem Ishto Chava Kihi Haisa Eim Kol Chai. So it must have been clear to Adam from the beginning that Chava was going to be the Eim Kol Chai. She was always the only female, right? There was never another option, right? That's how the joke goes. Rabbi Nathan Farber told the Meshul the other day that Chava was saying to Adam, "You know, you're always coming back late from wandering the gun. I'm concerned that there's another woman." He says, "You're literally the only woman on earth. I don't know what you're talking about." And one night, Adam is sleeping late at night, and he feels poking at his side. And he says, "Chava, what are you doing?" He says, "I'm counting your ribs." so Rabbi Farber pulls it off much better than I do. But she was literally the only person on earth. So obviously she was going to be Eim Kol Chai. It took him till a parak later to chap that she was going to be Eim Kol Chai. So he already had a mitzvah, Puruvu, Milus Haaretz, in the first parak. So what changed now that he finally named Chava after her maternal role, that he didn't name her at the beginning after the maternal role? She was just Isha at the beginning. So that's kasha number one. Kasha number two. We say Bori Morei Eish HaMatzai Shabbos during Havdalah based on a medrash in this week's Parsha, which says that Adam saw the world turn dark for the first time on Matzai Shabbos, and he was inspired to rub two stones together, at which time he discovered fire. And the question is, what the link is between Bori Morei Eish, the creation of fire, and Havdalah, meaning it's a coincidence of timing that he happened to discover fire on Matzai Shabbos, but it would seem to be a hefsek in the middle of Havdalah, meaning the fact that there's fire has nothing to do with Havdalah per se. It has to do with the fact that it's the anniversary of the discovery of fire. So why not just incorporate Borei Morei Eish as part of Lav Malka? Anyway, you're lighting candles from Lav Malka, right? Isn't that a thing? So why not just incorporate Borei Morei Eish as part of Lav Malka? Why is it part of Havdalah itself? So the Yisod seems to be as follows, that a person really typically can only truly recognize the value of something when there's a danger of not having it. meaning let's say a person was unable to walk due to an accident. So when he rehabilitates and he regains independence, he appreciates the simple ability to walk. You hear from kidney recipients all the time, the ability to urinate is something that they're like, they're so appreciative of. And, you know, when they regain it after having lost that ability. You know, Adam didn't say a bracha on the light that he experienced for the first 36 hours of creation, even though it was a much greater light than that which he was able to generate by rubbing some stones together, because until he saw darkness, he couldn't appreciate the value of light. He couldn't appreciate what that spark of light meant to him. So not only is that true attitudinally, but it reflects itself in language as well. Oftentimes in language, when an idea or an institution is threatened and needs to be kept alive, so a new word or a new phrase is coined by the defenders of that idea to preserve the idea's relevance, to preserve the salience of that idea. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Zichrono Livracha, writes in one of his books, Future Tense, Judaism in Israel in the 21st Century. On page 25, he writes that words are often born when the phenomenon they name is under threat. The adjective orthodox first appeared in a Jewish context in France in the early 19th century in the course of the debate about Jewish citizenship in the new nation state. For the first time in the modern world, the traditional terms of Jewish existence were thrown into question. Alternatives were proposed. Some argued that Judaism must change, like one Rav told me in Eretz Yisrael that some of the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael decided, Orthodox Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael decided that it's too difficult to schlep all the food up to the sukkah on the rooftop. It's time that the halacha recognizes a sukkah under a roof as a perfectly good sukkah. Orthodox rabbis, right? You know, that Judaism has to change. This is, an approach. And those who disagreed were given the label Orthodox. Why were they called Orthodox? They were always Orthodox, but they only needed a label Orthodox once Orthodoxy was something that was challenged and that was threatened. Right? An example that comes to mind is in the Shidduch world, when a girl says she's looking for a learner earner. My grandmother didn't look for a learner earner, right? When she was looking for a Shidduch, that wasn't even a thing to have someone who learns and earns, because it was never a question, right? It was taken for granted. If you're going to have a ksuba, it meant two things. It meant, first of all, that you're going to live up to the obligations written in the ksuba, i.e. earner, and it also meant that you're interested in a Jewish religious document, i.e. you're interested in Judaism, learner, right? Because every Jew has to learn. So there's no such thing as someone who's not. But once the concept became popular to never plan on making a living or to never plan on seeing the inside of a sefer, you know, once those ideas each in their own venues became popular, so then you needed this concept called learner earner. You need a title for something like that. So based on this, my friend Rabbi Baruch Dov Braun explains in his sefer that we can better appreciate Chava's name change. See, as a punishment for eating from the Eitz Hadas and for enticing her husband to eat as well, she's informed by Hashem that she's going to suffer when she gives birth, that giving birth wasn't going to be painless, it wasn't going to be harmless, it would be difficult, it would be painful, it would be dangerous. And at this point, it was no longer clear whether she would willingly subject herself to the torment and the struggle of childbearing. You know, before they had drugs to make it easier, it's still not so easy, but from what I'm told. But before they had painkillers to make it easier and to tolerate the burdens of pregnancy and labor. So before the Chere Etz Hadas, Chava's role as mother was taken for granted. It was obvious, right? She's Eim Kol Chai. Of course she is. You don't need to call her Chava. But now that that institution has been threatened, now that Adam had to worry that maybe she would opt out from motherhood, so a new word, Chava, which means mother of all life, had to be coined to defend the majesty of motherhood and to justify the ordeal of motherhood. And that idea relates to what Motzei Shabbos is all about. The holiness of Shabbos leaves us, and at that time, we begin to appreciate what Kedusha really is all about. You know, a person who experiences Kedusha Shabbos and sees it leaving can sense that he really needs Shabbos, and then can try to, you know, rub some spiritual flintstones together to create small sparks of Kedusha. In bells, there's a minhag at mincha in Simchas Torah that the gabe gives a clap and he announces that it's the last Shmona Esrei of the Heilig Tag, that it's the last Shmona Esrei of the Yom Tov season. They give a clap and they announce this is the last mincha in Simchas Torah. Is there a less inspired davening typically in the entire Yom Tov season? Most of Simchas Torah maybe, but you know, depending on the shul. But mincha and Simchas Torah, and he says this is it. This is the last one of the Yom Tov season. The Bali Musar had a similar minhag, a little bit different. That Marav Matzah Yom Kippur, they would announce that it's the first Shmona Esrei of the regular year. And the two are related. When a person appreciates a season of Kedusha, so you leave with a burning desire to continue that Kedusha, to continue that inspiration, and to bring it into the year. When we sense that there is that's something that's missing. You know, I said over in Shul on Shmini Atzeres Avart about Shmini Atzeres being representative of the idea of the end of the whole season of one mitzvah after another, and Kivus Elokim and this and that, to a sense of a more consistent and day-to-day kind of a Kirvas Elokim that a person can experience without all the bells and whistles that you have during the Yom Noraim. So someone in my shul who's very into Kabbalah told one of my kids, tell your dad that in Kabbalah they say the same thing. Of course they say the same thing in Kabbalah, meaning it's the most obvious point about Shmini Atzeres, right? In Halacha and in Drush and in Kabbalah and in everything. That's what Shmini Atzeres is. It's the bridge that brings you into the whole rest of the year. So when we feel this void of Kedusha after such a time of one after the other, of one Kedusha after the other, it's kedai to think of how it is that we're going to allow that Kedusha to affect our lives going forward, and how we're going to, you know, be better each year. I mentioned before Yom Kippur that you know, the kasha that people ask is how could we come and do tshuva and we're the same exact person that we were last year. Is a terrible kasha. You shouldn't be the same person you were last year. Figure out how you can be better, how you can be different. Not usually different, but a little bit different this year than you were last year. If you're the same person year after year in Yom Kippur, then yeah, maybe you don't deserve kapara on Yom Kippur. You know, like, what kind of kasha? You know, it's a person, of course, shouldn't be the same person year after year. But now's the time. Now's the time to put it into practice. Just parenthetically, this was a drush I gave last year. So last year at this time was the levaya of Rav Meisher David Tendler, Zecher Tzaddik Livracha, Rosh Yeshiva and Har Yeshiva. So I pointed out that he was the kind of person that needed new terminology. Because he broke every mold. Rabbi Berman in his Hesped described how Rav Tendler took the vav out of Torah Umada. That it was just like, it was one and the same. He wasn't a Rosh Yeshiva who happened to be a biology professor, or a biology professor who happened to be a Rosh Yeshiva. He was Rav Tendler. His shiurim were full of descriptions of modern shilas based on cutting-edge scientific information, and his biology lectures were full of Torah. And one of his children described a man who has a doctoral student at Columbia University and simultaneously a Rebbe in MTA would fall asleep on his pile of svarim at the kitchen table every night. That's how he went to sleep every night, just till he couldn't anymore. Maybe we never had a name for people like that because he was always just there. But, you know, we always knew that when the New York Times had to speak to somebody about the Jewish view on anything in science, on any advancement in science, the yeshiva was always able to give Rabbi Tendler's phone number, and they always had someone knowledgeable to speak to. He was part of the background of Jewish life in our country for 9 decades, and Rosh Yeshiva for over 7 decades, and now that he's not here anymore, it's kedai around his yahrzeit time to think about how now that you're missing something, to appreciate the value of something like that. Not that could ever be fully replaced, but that we now realize how badly we need someone like that, someone who is able to combine multiple areas of expertise and is able to present Torah knowledge or Torah hashkafa based on scientific knowledge to the broader world. So I just wanted to mention that as well. Okay.